All right, man. Welcome to the introduction to episode 51 for Crow 777 Radio Podcast. I have Jason Lindgren with me, and we are going to take a look at the Eastern mind, the Eastern way of thinking. After all, things like Freemasonry owe their roots and their ideas to things like Buddhism, Hinduism, and other supposed ancient religions which come out of India. When we look at the writings that we can still get our hands on, things like the Dhammapada, the Bhagavad Gita, you really do find a mindset that is very different than the Western mindset. In some ways, the Western mindset has become so materialistic as to be almost a polar opposite of what we see from the old writings in the East, or what we are told are old writings from the East. The opening lines of the Dhammapada I was first exposed to when I was much younger than I am now, and that teaching or those words say that the mind precedes everything. For me, these are true words. I've tested it, I've challenged it, and in fact, in my view, the mind does precede everything. It precedes your reality, it makes your reality, it precedes your illusion, it'll make your illusion. If we consider that the mind is a bit like software, to use an analogy, and everything that we see, the news, the media, the things that we learn, the things that we do in a day, are a bit like the programming for that software, the lines of code that are driving it. And you can really see how if a person just sat in front of cable news all day long, at some point when you talk to them, it's really like you're not talking to that person anymore. It's like you're talking to a programmed version of what the media has inserted into their minds. But anyhow, this is an interesting episode. For those of you that find something that resonates, maybe you'll take a look at things like the Dhammapada and just check out the differences between a culture in the East back in the day, we were told, and the way they were thinking about things and how we think about things in the West. And I think it's critical for us to do this. So few of us are able to travel these days for various reasons. Travel's become a big hassle to get on a plane. Here in the United States, the middle class is about decimated. So many of us just don't have the funds or the cash to go travel and see other parts of the world. You know, there's an old quote from Mark Twain. I don't remember exactly how it goes, but basically it comes down to travel is fatal to bigotry and this kind of idea. And I think there's a lot of truth there. When you go and explore other cultures, you find that they're just people like you and I. They bleed like you and I. They have children like you and I. They want the best for their families like you and I. And, you know, there's a lot to be said for that in the age where the news is constantly pushing fear. We need to be afraid of Middle Eastern people. We need to be afraid of Russia. There's a war coming. All this nonsense that is generated from the news with, you know, at the grassroots of things, if all of us, just the regular people, carefully looked at other cultures and got to know them and met the people, this would probably be a vastly different world. But anyhow, this episode seeks to very broadly demonstrate some of the thinking that came out of Eastern areas of our world and provided roots for some of the secret societies. And in my view, those are perversions. Things like Freemasonry have perverted the teachings that they based what they got, seemingly watered down versions, but where we find in the Eastern ideas that these teachings were supposed to be for everybody, a path for anyone and everyone. And then when we get into the secret societies, it's not that at all. But anyhow, let's jump into episode 51 with Jason Lindgren. Cheers. All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio Podcast. This is, where are we, Jason? Are we on 51 here? I think we are on 51.
Yep.
We're going to be taking a look. We're going to step away a bit from a typical show because we cover so many things that people could find depressing. And I wanted to step back and compare and contrast the mindsets of the Eastern part of the world with the Western part of the world. And in that, we will have to explain in very high level, not really detailed, but high level terms, certain belief systems and certain mindsets that have come from the East. Almost all these things are coming out of India if you follow them all the way back. But the reason I think it matters is because almost certainly the modern Masonic traditions and the supposed secrets that they claim to hold their lineages back through things like Buddhism, Hinduism, and other ancient Indian traditions. Most people aren't aware of this, but it almost seems like a lot of the occult knowledge that was initially
in the world at some time seems to have stemmed out of India. And there are plenty of examples that you can go look up and read that demonstrate that Masonry seems to have its lineage through these paths back through the Eastern occult traditions and religious traditions, but almost like they got a watered down version of it. In what we cover, there is a top level idea that people should be aware of. It's even, you know, I made a joke of it in the thumbnail, the line from the Zeppelin song. Yes, there are two paths you can go down, but in the long run, the idea here is that there is a dark path and a light path. In some of the traditions we're going to talk about, it is supposed, and by the way, I'm not upping any religion or downing any religion. I'm simply putting information out on the table for people to consider because I think it's important for people in the West to know something about people of the East, vice versa. But it is supposed that in the light path and these traditions, the people that follow a path of so-called light, and you'll notice how that relates to masonry by their own claims, that you leave this world on that path. It is further supposed that on a dark path, you're recycled back into this world. And again, I'm not telling you whether these things are true or false. I am addressing the systems that have come down and been adopted by Western systems like masonry. But anyhow, welcome, Jason.
Hey, I think this is going to be an interesting talk.
Yeah, we got to thread the needle here. I'm hoping we can get people to consider the things we're talking about. Maybe for people who have never heard anything about Buddhism or any of the other Eastern philosophies, which really demonstrates a different kind of mindset. As an example, here in the West, you know, you'll meet a lot of people that have never seen a dead body. And in our daily life, we push death away. It's almost like a Western cultural tradition. And someone in your family dies, you may or may not even see them before the man whisks them away under these surgical conditions. And the next thing, you're handed this thing of ashes. And we go through our lives never having considered it. Well, by contrast, in a lot of the Eastern traditions, much of the daily life that they consider is with the understanding that someday this is going to end. And what can we do now to provide a better path for when that day comes? And actually, it even goes further than that in a lot of traditions. We'll talk about it a bit. What happens after we die? Right. And while I'm not claiming that there's some hard, fast, you know, guaranteed book you can read that tells you what happens after you die, I am telling you that I think it's very important to understand what other very seemingly very old traditions do.
Yeah, and the one thing I could say after re-examining Eastern philosophies versus Western philosophies is that a lot of Western culture is about denial and just not dealing with a situation. That's in the body thing is a very good example of that.
Right. And I mean, death is the perfect example of that. We're taught to fear it when that doesn't really make much sense because every living thing that we ever see is going to die. So if it's that common, if it's that universal, why is it a thing to be feared and why isn't it addressed in a more open manner?
Yeah, exactly. So before we start really getting into descriptions of the various philosophies of the East, I thought it might be cool to have a discussion on what paths you've taken in your life and why you've drawn so much from the Eastern philosophies.
Well, one thing about the Eastern philosophies, and I will preface this conversation by stating flat out, verbatim, I belong to no organization or organized religion of any kind. I am my own person, and I believe that each person has the ability to lift themselves spiritually as a human being to higher levels, and they don't. It's great to have a teacher if you meet a good one in life, but in terms of joining a group, that's just not the way I choose to go. But initially, when I began at a very, very young age, probably still in my late teens, to look at other traditions, I began to realize that in some of them, you're being told, don't believe this, challenge it. As an example, there's a text called the Dhammapada, and the opening lines of that text have meant a lot to me my entire life. And it basically comes down to that your mind precedes your reality. Mind precedes everything. And I've covered that before in this show. You can logically go at that and break that down and understand that it is really not an arguable thing if you have the mind to do it. And when you contrast it to where we are in the West, like with something like all the false news that comes at us, well, what is that false news doing? Well, it's changing our minds, isn't it? And so if our mind truly does precede everything, then these things that are going on in information systems are certainly geared at affecting our minds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyhow, I don't know how well I answered that, Jason, but you can keep pushing through, or you can readdress the question if I let something drop there.
No, that's fine. I just kind of wanted to see where you were at with it. And I kind of went through something similar where I was raised in a Methodist home, but very, very loose. And once I got into my mid to late teens, I started exploring different, just kind of everything, really. I started looking at different religions, different faiths and all that. I've had various spiritual experiences over the course of my lifetime. So nothing I have ever experienced has nailed down any one religion for me, just proven to me the existence that there is more than what we perceive in the physical reality. So I'm extremely open-minded about everything, and the one thing I know is that I don't know.
Yeah, and to be clear, I'm less interested in religions of any kind. What I am interested in is the knowledge, the things that I can challenge, the things that I can either adopt or throw away or temporarily say this is interesting. And for a lot of the Eastern traditions, and I will preface, even in early Christianity, you can find that meditation was a big part of things, and it seems to have kind of bled away from what the West does in Christianity now. But early on, there were vows of silence and all kinds of mind sciences associated with Christianity. That was one of the things that really began to pique my interest in the Eastern philosophies, because the idea was the betterment, not just saying I believe in a thing, but trying to actually train your mind to do better. And that's what really got me looking harder, looking at more cultures, going back through India, looking at everything I could get my hands on, regardless of country, just to see what these people were doing in terms of betterment, actually working on trying to better yourself in this lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of obvious when you do look at all these that the modern version of Christianity is kind of like a watered-down version of the earlier philosophies that are from the East. You can see how things kind of filtered through as humankind would have spread out throughout the world.
Well, I think the truth, you could say the same things about Buddhism, I believe, Jason, where, if someone was to come up and ask me, was the Buddha a real person? The first things that I notice is, well, of course, he's got the glowing head. And then when you begin to look in it, it certainly begins to look like the sun is being encoded in these ideas. But you see, there are levels and levels of information in almost any major religion. Although, as an example, I don't think Buddhism is counted as a major religion anymore. I think it might have been when I was a kid. But anyhow, that's not really what I'm interested in. I have met people who were lamas and others. As a matter of fact, I will say this. This is one thing that had a huge effect on me. When I was probably in my 20s, I saw a piece of footage where a lama, I think probably in Nepal, was doing his death meditation, and he completely went into death, totally in control, sitting upright even after he was gone and the monks came and put a shroud on him. As a matter of fact, there's a movie out there called, I think it's called Little Buddha with Keanu Reeves, where they actually, you know, do a scene with this idea in it. But this was a real thing where they had actually filmed a monk going into his death meditation, and he met death in a way that was completely foreign to me. I mean, I was a Western person thinking, man, death is far away. I don't need to think about this. I'm afraid of death, all these things. And here was a man who came in, went into meditation in an upright position, sitting or kneeling or whatever it was. I think he was sitting. He had robes on, and he died in that same position, seemingly taking on death, totally in control of his mind. And that was one of the things that really hooked me.
And how different from the very violent evil portrayal, you almost might say, of the Western media that we're handed on a day-to-day basis.
Well, this is the conundrum for me. This is one of the things that's helped me push mainstream news and other things and movies and violence so far away, because we're all going to die. Every single one of us is going to die. That means it is just another step in our existence. So how is it that we're all taught to fear this thing that we're not getting away from? I mean, even every bird you see, every plant you see, all of us are in the same boat here. And when I saw a human being go into death in that way, I thought, wait a minute, I got to know more about this.
Right. And as we're going to start going through these, you can see that that is kind of right at the core of the way that these early Eastern philosophy viewed it, too. It's an acceptance of reality, really.
Really, and in a lot of ways, it's just really keen observation. And we're about to just break down some of the Buddhist tenets as a starting point. And again, I'm not trying to convert anyone to Buddhism or convert anyone away from it. This is strictly just a knowledge-based look at these traditions so that people can have in their mind what other parts of the world have as their, you know, their daily thought process, the way they live. We're here in the West. We have our way. Other parts of the world have their ways. But I would submit, we're all people. We're all the same. We all bleed. We all have children, or a lot of us do, and we want the best for our children. In these commonalities, we should learn that any old culture probably has something to teach us. And that's why I go at it in the way that I do.
Right. And the preface to all this is the reality of any historical reality to these figures. It's very questionable. Some of them that are more recent probably did exist, but some of these earlier ones, Buddha and all that, they're really not sure. It could be an amalgamation of different monks or stories kind of put together. So just with all religious iconic figures, bear in mind that they're not what we're going to go through. It may not necessarily be historically accurate, but more of a representation.
Right. And for me, that doesn't even matter anymore. I don't, you know, I'm suspect of all historical personages. The further back in history they supposedly come from, the more suspect I am. But that's not what's important to me here. As an example, what's important to me is the idea of examining the suffering of the world. That's a big part of the initial steps into Buddhism, where they take the time to examine what they see going on in the life of any given thing around them. Those are the things that I think are critical, because you can examine them, challenge them, and you're not stuck in the position of saying, wait a minute, did this person really exist? I set all that aside. I'm more interested in the philosophy and the things that I can challenge.
Right. And that's the important part, is understanding why we're discussing this in the first place, what the philosophical backgrounds and why this became something that all these monks flourished for centuries and why they embraced it. So the first one, of course, we're going to discuss is the Buddha, who's also known as the Awakened One. The story of the Buddha's life, like all of Buddhism's philosophies, is a story about confronting suffering. He is said to have been the son of a wealthy king living somewhere between the 4th and 6th centuries BC. There was a prophecy made to the king that this person, his son, would become either the emperor of India or a very holy man. His father, of course, wanted him to become an emperor, so he kept him living in luxury, completely isolated in a palace for 29 years. He then started leaving the palace for short excursions. First, he met a sick man, next time an aging man, and then a dying man. He found that these unfortunate people were actually a normal representation of everyday people. The things he saw were inevitable parts of the human condition that would one day touch him as well. He was horrified and fascinated, and is said to have made a fourth trip outside the palace, and this time he encountered a holy man. This holy man had learned to seek spiritual life in the midst of the vastness of human suffering. This inspired him to leave the palace for good. He tried to learn from other holy men. He starved himself by avoiding all physical comforts, as he saw them doing, but this did not bring him solace from suffering. He then thought of a moment when he was a small boy sitting by a river. He noticed that when the grass had been cut, the insects and their eggs were trampled and destroyed. He had felt a deep compassion for them even as a child. So, thinking on this compassion, he felt a profound sense of peace. He ate, meditated, and then reached the highest state of enlightenment, known as nirvana. This is said to be the blowing out of the flames of desire. With this profound self-realization, he had become the Buddha, or the Awakened One. He recognized that all of creation are all unified by suffering.
Right. And so let's preface. That was really a very kind of nutshell, and actually one of the many versions of the story of the supposed Buddha's life. But the things that are important here is the idea of this place being surrounded with suffering, and how do we address the suffering in our lives? And the idea in the Eastern mindset that in this story, as one of the examples, and there are many variations on this, he even felt compassion for these little bugs because they were alive. These are kind of mindsets that we don't really have too much in the West, which is why I think it's so important to look at them. And I would remind everybody that if in fact it is true that the Masonic traditions in the West owe their roots to these Eastern mindsets, then there is a there that we should look at and examine and challenge.
Yep, absolutely. So in the next part of the story, recognizing all this unification of suffering, he discovered how best to approach suffering. We shouldn't bathe in luxury or abstain from food and comforts altogether. Instead, one should live in moderation. This he called the middle way. This allows for maximal concentration on cultivating compassion for others and seeking enlightenment.
So in the West, we actually have an old cliched saying that addresses this very thing, all things in moderation. It's really no different. Quite often, people would be familiar with the story of a man tuning a stringed instrument where he's teaching his students, saying, see, if the string is too tight, it's not correct. If it's too slack, it won't play. But if it's that medium middle way, it's just right, and you can play music. There are many versions of this kind of Eastern philosophy. And again, we have a companion way of thinking with moderation in the West.
It's also the whole too much excess, it leads to decadence and all that. So a lot of these kings and rich people would be seen to be living in absolute luxury apart from the masses, which generally were poor and sometimes even starving and sick and all that, and had next to nothing. So, you know, that we don't think of it as much in Western culture, because even the poorer people here in Western culture have more than a lot of people would have in the past.
Right. And what's interesting to me is what you're about to talk about, how they examine these ideas and they try to kind of codify them. They break them down into parts so they can begin to address them. And I would also point out, you know, maybe the seven deadly sins, you know, the ideas from the West in some way relates to this way of thinking.
Right. So next we have A Path to Transcending Suffering, The Four Noble Truths. The first, there is suffering and constant dissatisfaction in the world.
This is an interesting thing for people who have never encountered these ideas about the Four Noble Truths, which, again, you should challenge these things. You should think about them. If there's something there you think is valuable, then great. If not, then you should throw it aside. Simple as that. And I think in a lot of these traditions, it actually tells you that. But we in the West tend to think we're happy when we have a nice home, when we have a good car, when we're making a lot of money. But in what we're about to break down here, that is actually piling on the suffering. We just don't realize it. It's a bit like being in a prison cage for so long that you don't want to be outside the prison cage anymore because you're so used to and have gotten used to how exist in the prison cage. But anyhow, go ahead, Jason.
The second, the suffering is caused by our desires. Attachment is the root of all suffering. The third, we can transcend suffering by removing or managing these desires. We must change our outlook, not our circumstances. We are unhappy not because we don't have enough money, love, or status, but because we are greedy, vain, and insecure. By reorienting our mind, we can grow to be content. The people become happier, superimpose smiles, or use a second image of their face. With the correct behavior and what we now term a midfield attitude, we can also become better people. We can invert negative emotions and states of mind, turning ignorance into wisdom, anger into compassion, and greed into generosity.
Mind precedes all plays into that. Go ahead.
And the fourth, we can learn to move beyond suffering through the Noble Eightfold Path. This involves a series of aspects of behaving right and wisely, and they are as follows: right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration.
So you can see how this is now starting to get off into mind sciences and this simple kind of you know, fourfold path or the Four Noble Truths starts to break off. Now it's up to eight. This goes on and on in these traditions, and it just shows the extent to which they will observe and address and challenge the ideas that are being set forth. And it's an interesting thing. Recently, a family member of mine was in an auto accident, and they required a surgeon to fix a broken bone. And it turned out that the surgeon was headed off to offer his orthopedic skills in Bhutan. And I was talking to him about it. And it was an interesting conversation because we were both aware that in Bhutan, although there is still a king there, I believe recently in Bhutan, they're going to more what they call democracy. By the way, television just made it into Bhutan. So we'll see how long anything lasts there that used to be. I asked him, you know, have you been to this part of the world before? He's all, yeah, I've actually donated my surgery skills there many times. I've been all over that parts of the world. And I asked him about it. And he said, the one thing he told me flat out, I don't think any religion has figured it all the way out. I don't belong to any of these religions. But he made this observation in the Buddhist nations that were there. He said he's never seen a more contented and happier group of people, which I thought was interesting. But then we started talking about the king in Bhutan, and the primary concern, supposedly, of this government is a thing called gross national happiness. That's one of the primary concerns, and that is such a contrast to the West, where we're all sitting here suffering with corporations. I mean, right now I'm dealing with insurance companies. It's like a nightmare. And I sometimes think in Bhutan, you know, is it true? Is there gross national happiness there? Are all the people really acting like this is a thing they can hold on to and benefit from? I've never been there, so I can only take it on secondhand. But there's a real contrast between that part of the world, speaking with a person who's been there, and how we live here.
Western observers would note that the notion of wisdom is a habit, not merely an intellectual realization, which is a lot of people in Western society are kind of looking for that aha moment. The idea here is that you're cultivating wisdom throughout your life. It's an approach. So one must exercise one's nobler impulses on a regular basis as one would train a limb. The moment of understanding is only one part of becoming a better person. So basically, it's a lifestyle choice.
Right. And this is another interesting thing. And this doesn't pertain to just Buddhism, although I know in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of lineage. In other words, if there's some teaching that they have a lineage all the way back to the person who supposedly founded this idea or this path. And if the chain of custody of this teaching is ever broken, then it's invalidated. To me, that was a big deal. As a young person, I was exposed to Western law, the idea of the chain of custody of evidence. And if it was broken, then the evidence couldn't be used anymore. And this is so important to me, because when we get things like the news now, there's no chain of custody. There's no tracing back where this information came from, and it's all nonsense. And so this was another thing that I thought was a very interesting idea. And to me, it offered some validity, a reason to look, a reason to challenge, a reason to seek some meaning there, because why were these people taking so much time to say, I got this teaching from this guy who got it from this guy who got, and it would go back hundreds of years, maybe over 1,000 in many cases. And I thought that was a big deal. But anyhow, go ahead, Jason.
Well, let's say that the notable point of all this, backing off from the notion of it being religion, but just more a viewpoint, regardless of an individual's spiritual identification or their religious beliefs, these teachings are important because no matter what, we are all born into the world without the realization of how much suffering it actually holds. So these teachings are a reminder of the importance of facing suffering directly. We must do our best every day to liberate ourselves from the hold our own desires have over us. We must recognize that our suffering is the one connection we all have in common. This should inspire us all to be compassionate and gentle, and I can completely agree with that.
Well, yeah. And in a lot of ways in the West, we have rampant materialism, which in a way seeks to mask the idea that there's any suffering going on. In other words, I just got this great new car, or I got this great new house, or I got a big promotion at work. I'm making a lot of money. It almost in a way masks our ability to understand that really none of those things took away the suffering and the end idea that we all have to go through the door called death. As a matter of fact, in the Western tradition, having been brought up Christian myself, you know, look at the big Christian holiday. It's Christmas. I mean, that is rampant materialism. There's really no religious portion for most people left in Christmas. It's just become this materialistic idea where we do all these things because that's the way we've always done it. And that's another reason why I think it's important to look at these other mindsets.
Right. There's a couple things I'd like to add in here, just starting off with the Buddhist philosophy. In Western culture, everyone's all about the accumulation of wealth and, just as you said, materialism and all that. And, you know, you hear it said that millionaires and billionaires sometimes are the most miserable people in the world. It's almost like a chain to them. That wouldn't surprise me because, to be perfectly honest with you, as long as you have enough to get by and survive in a reasonable way without struggling or starving, obviously, materialism is just distraction. You're just looking to go from one distraction to the next. So the more money you have, you're just doing bigger and bigger distractions because you're not actually focusing on things that are important, such as being compassionate and caring for yourself and others.
Right. And I broke this down in a show or two ago where I was talking about, you know, we basically sleep for a third of our life. We work for roughly a third of our life. And then in that the only third we have left to, you know, live and look around and learn and grow, we have to deal with so many of the things that all this materialism brings. I have a car now. I have to get insurance. I'm making a lot of money now, or I have a house. So I have to deal with all these things that are wrapped into that. It's almost like the materialistic system is by design like quicksand. It's like the more you get, the further you slip in because you have to deal with each little thing you add. It's crazy to think about.
Well, I think that's absolutely intentional. You know, whoever the true bad guys behind all of the things going on in the world are, I would say that they don't need to put chains on us anymore. They've done it economically. You know, they've got us all trained to want more and more and more, and we have to work and achieve to have these things. And the reality of it is, we really don't need that much. We need shelter, we need food, you know, all those kinds of things. But you don't need the Lamborghini. The Honda Fit I have is actually quite good enough, and I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, if you could consider some of the stuff we're going to cover here, where supposedly there were people who left society to go do meditation to try to become higher human beings. But you see, the culture they were in provided for that. There would be people who are everyday workaday people, farmers or others, who would provide, or maybe a monastery would make sure that person had food delivered so that they could sit in that cave or on that mountaintop and pursue these mind sciences. When you bring that back around to what if someone in, you know, here in Rhode Island, where I am, decided they wanted to do that. We don't have any, you know, built-in way for that kind of thing to go on. It would be pretty difficult for the average person. And it goes to show that foundationally in the West, most of our culture is built on materialism at this point. And so trying to step away from the construct around us becomes a lot more difficult if you think about it.
Absolutely. And these people, of course, their lifestyle is to live with less. Now, I'm not saying that, let me put it this way. I love technology. I love having these things here. I love to create with technology. So it's not that I think either one of us is suggesting to just give it all up and go live in a cave somewhere. It's more the point of really looking at life and being appreciative for what you have and realize that what you really don't need.
Right. You know, I saw a documentary not too long ago about television arriving in Bhutan. And again, this is a place where supposedly gross national happiness is a big deal to the entire culture, including supposedly the king, if these are true things. In that, there was a family who would work in the field, and the adult female had told, I think, an uncle, look, you've got to go trek 3 days to get a TV because I'd like the television to take care of my kids so I can go out in the field and work more at ease. And I'm watching this go on. So they set off on this trek to go get this TV. And by the way, the first TV falls off a horse and gets broken. So I think they have to go back and get another one. So you can begin to see the suffering attached to the materialism. But
that also sounds like the universe trying to tell them something.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with television just making it into Bhutan. But at one point, the uncle is there with the child, who's apparently going to be taken care of by the television while the mother's in the field. And the first thing they see in the big city is wrestling, Western-style wrestling. And the kid asked the uncle, the child asked the uncle, "Uncle, uncle, is that real?" And the uncle says, "I don't think it could be real, because for a human being to take that much of a beating, they would have to be dead, but I don't know for sure." And I thought that so encapsulates the world that we live in here. But anyhow, anyone with an interest to see what happens next is, you know, apparently television is just now making it into Bhutan. So, you know, I would imagine before too many years goes by, there's going to be some real changes and the westernization of this place will begin to set in.
Well, this is the problem. They're not using television as a tool. You know, the actual concept of the television isn't necessarily bad. If they're letting in Western garbage like wrestling, and I'm sorry if you like wrestling, it's just entertainment. I don't have a problem with it from that standpoint, but it's not anything. It's just another distraction. It's if you like it, that's cool, you know. But
think about this, Jason. So here you're in Bhutan, the city they're going to get the television is in Bhutan, and the programming is violence or mock violence. You don't think there's probably intent behind that? When I watched it, I certainly thought, you know, why would you go into a Buddhist nation where gross national happiness and the apparent respect for all living things is high on their culture? Would you put violence or mock violence as one of the programs that goes in there? You can kind of see the intent behind it, I think.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting at. The television itself as a device is not necessarily a bad thing, but that's what you're putting on there instead of using it as maybe an information tool or, you know, that kind of thing. Just like a computer, you can do anything you want with it. And I have a problem with that. Why are they introducing television and the first thing they do is give them trash TV?
Well, if the supposed king there still has any say in things, or whether he's been co-opted by the wave that's going over the world, which is probably true, why wouldn't you be telling your people maybe you don't want TV? Because you would have to know what it's done all over the world. You know, the idea that it's just a tool kind of, in my mind, falls short because, yeah, maybe it is just a tool like a knife or a sword. You could sit there and carve something or you could kill someone. But we all kind of know what's happened with TV and who has control over it. So if it was a knife, nothing beautiful is ever going to get carved with that TV. We know what it's going to do.
Right. And I would be curious if they have internet access. You know, do some people have computers and are able to connect with the wider world? And if so, then they would have a bigger idea of what's out there. You know, they're not just farmers and only knew that lifestyle and that's it.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting thing to watch. You know, I don't watch a lot of things, but I sat down and I watched that front to back and I just thought, wow, it'll be interesting to see what happens on the tail of this.
All right, so Buddhism spread out. And the next big name that kind of comes up would be Confucius, and I'm sure everyone's probably heard of him. He is said to have been born in 551 BC in China, and he may have also been a student of the Taoist master Lao Tzu, who we will also get to. His works were collected into what's called the Analects. This is a collection of his sayings that were written down by his followers. Now, he had his own version of the Golden Rule: do not do unto others what you don't want done to yourself.
And again, we have versions of this in the West, and I think we even have what we call the Golden Rule, which is basically this. So you can see how some of these teachings kind of transcend culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, a lot of these things really are just basic common sense, too. Just like with Christianity, I mean, when you boil it down, it's just be nice to each other. Don't be a jerk, you know? Like, society flourishes if everyone's cool with each other, you know?
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's a lot to be gleaned from each of these things. And I think resonance is a big part of what we're going to cover. I think maybe some people would look at a particular thing and there might not be resonance there for them. And so it would probably mean less to that individual. But for some, they'll find resonance here and there. And maybe that's a way for them to find out some things that they can challenge and then either accept or discard.
The other thing I really like about Eastern philosophies that maybe we could put here is that although it's like a philosophy you follow, like I don't want to say you're part of a group, but a mindset perhaps, it's still about individualism. Your journey is still your own through meditation and all that. That's not something you share with anyone else. You are your own mind, and what you're getting out of the meditation is unique to you, and no one else couldn't possibly get inside that. So that's something that I really like about Eastern philosophy is still it's very, very much about individualism.
Right. In a way, maybe it's kind of like someone choosing to be a vegetarian, right? You know, it's not necessarily that they've joined the vegetarian organization. I mean, in some ways they have, but more truly, it's a personal decision, right? I'm going to do this personally and monitor what I put in my body because I think this is correct. And that becomes exactly what you're pointing out here. It's a personal decision where it's a personal observation for personal betterment that really doesn't have a lot to do with an overarching organization as a whole.
I can also relate this to something that you have to deal with on a regular basis. People are always trying to drag you into the whole flat earth thing. And that's a group. A lot of people are out there battling on a daily basis and arguing the fact that the earth is flat versus the earth is round. You don't do that. You're just saying this is what I'm seeing based off of observations, but I'm not putting my foot in any camp. You're just looking at it objectively and saying, I have done this work. This is what I see.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a perfect example. And to some degree, you've nailed it. I can say what I observe. I can say what I've challenged and I currently think is likely correct, but I can't give you a new map of this place. And even if any of these ideas that are now coming pretty solidly into place that are, you know, refuting the orbital model, I always choose to go more broadly because at the root of these things, if we begin to prove some of them out, the questions that arise are much bigger than the actual starting point. I think it's more helpful to go at it as an individual, make your observations, add what you can, and throw it out there. If it sticks to the wall, then people will benefit. But the minute you begin saying, you know, I'm a member of the Flat Earth Organization, these other things, it almost implies that you can draw a new map of the world now. And I just don't really think that's helpful.
Right. And the reason why I bring that up is because I've heard you on a lot of other shows. You know, I've heard just about everything you've done, especially before you and I became friends. I always thought it was very interesting because one of the first things anyone tried to do was put you in a box. And I didn't like that because the first thing you would say is like, well, hold on here, you know. So that is like absolutely something that human beings as a rule do. They want to chop and dice and put things in individual little parts and say, well, I know what this is. This is this person. Crow is a flat earther. That's what he is. And that's how I'm going to start this interview. And this is where I'm going to go with it. And the first thing you do is say, now, hang on a second. That's not what I said.
No. What I say is I don't accept the orbital model. What I say is we're not in the spin cycle. You know, I don't accept these things. I know from firsthand observation, I know that we can see too far. And that says a lot about what we've been told. But in no way, shape, or form does that allow me to draw a new map. But at the same time, I'm very happy to see people out there trying to draw the new map. So important. But once you begin to join the groups, you know, if the group does something silly, you kind of inherit some of that silliness. And if they start to believe in things that are, you know, mistakes, then you kind of inherit that. And you can see where it's almost like the cascade effect, where maybe it would be better off if everybody just went off at their own direction with their own method. Maybe it's not scientific. Maybe it's not even rational. But whatever it is you think you've got, throw it out there. See if it matters. And if it does, then hopefully it goes further. It's a good point, Jason.
Right. And the only reason I'm bringing this up at all is I want everyone who's listening to this just to remember to be yourself. Don't go along with something just because a group is. You know. And this is what something I myself am drawing from the Eastern philosophy is just remember that you're your own person and make your decisions based off your own personal observations. So anyway, getting back to Confucius, the next thing he would push is that ceremony is very important. He valued what he called ritual propriety, things that we would look forward to on a regular basis that would bring us comfort and stir our emotions deeply.
Yeah, this is an interesting idea because in other Eastern traditions I've read about, like the Brahmanism, there were Buddhists who had a problem with all the ritual things that had crept into Brahmanism. But in some ways, if you examine what's being said here, it's almost like the Western idea of idle hands are the devil's tools. You know, if you really think about it and break it down, where we're doing these things and not necessarily because the ritual itself has some magical power, but what it does is keeps us from straying and doing these other things that might be helpful. And I know that's kind of a broad approach here, but I do kind of see a Western mirror in the idea of idle hands or the devil's playthings.
Well, the other thing that Confucius was getting at here is that it's okay to have things that bring you comfort, like examples I saw used in some of the material I went through was there's a place you like to go on your birthday every year. It's just something you look forward to. It doesn't actually mean anything. It's just, I'm celebrating my birthday. I like to go here and eat this dinner. It brings you joy and comfort. Good.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And the truth of this is, in a lot of the traditions that we examine, you know, if you wanted to be a hardcore monk, you're basically checking off the grid in a way, out of culture. And that's not really possible for most of us in the Western world. So the truth is, you know, let's examine what's going on here. We all know we got to have a car to get to work. We all know we got to make money to eat. And so that kind of dictates how far we jump into any of these ideas. But at the base of it, if we change our minds, we really have changed something.
Well, the other thing is, if you were a monk, the smaller things would be a lot of times all the joy you would have. So a particular ceremony or situation might be the thing that brings you joy. And this gets back to the earlier Buddhist, the thing that Buddha would say is that, you know, all things in moderation, the middle path. It's okay to have some things that bring you comfort. You don't have to completely abstain from everything.
That's right. And you'll find if you really examine in depth, as I have, like Tibetan Buddhism, one of the ideas is the further up the ladder you get towards this goal of being liberated or free or enlightened or whatever you want to call it, is that emotion falls away, is that emotion is wasted motion. The idea that, you know, someone in your family died, but you don't cry because you've gone beyond the need to have that kind of emotion, where if we examine that in the West, the average person would look at that and think, what's the matter with that person? They just lost a family member and they're not crying, and they would find fault with it. But this is exactly why we need to look at these things.
Well, again, this goes back to the fact that the suffering was accepted from the beginning, you know, that I already knew this person was going to die. I've already accepted the fact that this person's going to die, you're going to die, I'm going to die. So it's a little different than the Western mentality where this is kind of a problem with it. If you cut yourself off from things and then when they happen, they're a lot more jarring and shocking to your psyche because you haven't thought about this before, at least not probably very much.
Right. It's a good point. But there is no getting away from in these meditative traditions. Emotion is one of the things that goes away. And for the average person listening, you know, we talk about the elite or the royal families. And one of the complaints we hear so often is they're cold. You know, they're cold blooded. How is it that they can't have compassion for all these people they're affecting? So it's a real conflict of ideas here.
Yeah, absolutely. The next thing with Confucius is that we should treat our parents with reverence. We should obey them when we are young, care for them when they are old, mourn at length when they die, and make huge sacrifices in their memory thereafter. He also said that we shouldn't travel far away while our parents are alive and should cover for them if they steal a sheep. This is what he called filial piety. His notion is that our moral lives begin in the family and that we cannot truly be caring, wise, grateful, and conscientious unless we properly honor our parents.
So this goes a bit further than the Western tradition, but we certainly have in Christianity a counterpart for this in the Ten Commandments. And most people are, you know, honor thy father and mother. So we do have a counterpart, but it is interesting to see how far he goes with it here. But anyhow, keep going.
Right. And that is interesting. I agree with the groundwork that's being laid there in the sense that, you know, unless there's something actually wrong with your family and your parents are jackasses or something, the whole point is that these are the people who are going to try their best to bring you up the right way and instill in you proper moral concepts. So that's a good thing. Now, do you have to take it as far as this? I don't think so, but it's important to at least be respectful of the concept, and that's how I feel about that.
Well, one of the funny things here is, and you should cover for them if they steal a sheep.
That is funny.
And if you begin to break that down, well, stealing a sheep is wrong, right? So why are you covering for the thing that is wrong? But here the idea is that the familial relationship trumps all else, I guess.
Right, that you keep to your own, and that is the blood is thicker than water kind of thing, you know?
Right. You know, and actually some of the Buddhist traditions, there are what's called unpardonable sins, and one of them is to kill your mother or father. It's stated in some of the things that I've studied that if you do that, that's it, man. You're in big trouble, and there ain't no way you're getting out from under it. So there's another side of that whole life, familial idea. Go ahead.
Next, we should be obedient to honorable people. I actually really like this one, by the way. I think this is something that we should all do because we have such a rigid corporate mentality now banged into us in the Western world that this is interesting. This is an interesting way of looking at things. So let the ruler be a ruler, the subject a subject, a father, and a son a son. The idea is that there are people worthy of our deep veneration and even our simple and humble obedience. We need to be modest enough to recognize the people whose experience or accomplishments outweigh our own. We should also peaceably practice what these people need, ask, or command. The relation between superiors and inferiors is like that between the wind and the grass. The grass must bend when the wind blows across it. Bending gracefully is not a sign of weakness, but a gesture of humility and respect. I absolutely love that one.
So this really speaks to the sign of the times, though, you know, in the West, with everyone's, you know, so mistrustful of all leadership because we begin to see what's gone on. It's really hard to start to put this into practice in terms of, you know, let the ruler be the ruler when you can see the wrong that's being done. But if you take it down a few levels where there are probably people in your society, maybe the man who runs the baker, who is completely an honorable man, but you've already started to reshape the idea in the way it's said here. This is a very interesting thing to observe. Seemingly, maybe there was a time when things were not so mistrustful, but you know, you try to apply this to now, particularly at the highest levels of rulers being rulers, and it's almost impossible to make it fit. It's almost impossible to balance the ledger in some ways.
Well, the other thing you can look at here is that corporations are modern day lords and kings. You know, the head of the corporation, you will obey him. He's a dictator. It doesn't matter what you may know or is right or wrong. If the CEO says it, it is so. And even if he or she is completely wrong, you know, the line level person working in the factory or the store or whatever it happens to be may know far better based off of experience because they're there on the battlefield, as it were. And they don't care. They don't want to hear from you. Their word is it. And that's why I think this philosophical viewpoint is very important.
Yeah, for me, I just have a really hard time jiving it with the modern time we find because so many of the kind of corporateness, the corporate fence that's around almost every facet of our Western life is problematic to me. And it almost seems like a tool that was built that no longer serves the purpose it was built for, in my eyes anyhow. But go ahead, Jason.
Well, corporate structure is also very militaristic in the sense that there's ranks, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's no getting away from it. I spend so much of my time pointing out how woefully short it all falls that when I take, you know, Confucius's idea there, I get it. I respect it. But there are certain portions of the reality that I find myself in right now where I don't think I could reconcile it.
And just to finish up on that point, I think it's being humble enough to recognize the fact that you, no matter what situation, you are not the be-all, end-all of that situation. There are others who could contribute to your point of view. And
good point.
Yeah. So moving on, we have the next point that Confucius makes. Cultivated knowledge can be more important than creativity. Confucius was adamant about the importance of the universal wisdom that comes from years of hard work and reflection. Benevolence, ritual propriety, righteousness, wisdom, and integrity are the five constant virtues. He believed that people were inherently good, but he also saw that virtues like these must be constantly cultivated like plants in a garden. He spoke of moral character and wisdom as the work of a lifetime. A burst of inspiration may be what we need to get something going, such as a new company, or maybe you're writing music or something. But if we're being honest with ourselves, we must admit that we also need to devote more energy to slowly changing our habits for the better. This, more than anything else, is what prevents us from becoming truly accomplished and wise.
You know, it's interesting to consider that, you know, what's the claim here? 5-something BC is the supposed life of a supposed man named Confucius. But when you look at a lot of the teaching, and you may or may not find value depending on the person and the resonance they find in it, but then you know that communism came along not too long after. And I would say keep that in mind as you read through some of this. It's almost like communism was built knowing that some of these ideas were important within the culture, in a way, to me anyhow.
Right. And to kind of tie up the Confucius point of view and how these two philosophies of Buddha and Confucius relate to the Western world, it's almost the total opposite mentality, really. You know, it's Western culture, as I was saying, is very egalitarian. And it is full of innovation, which is the one thing I do like. Because it's kind of set up as a dog-eat-dog world, everyone's trying to outdo each other. It's a individuality for individuality's sake, you might say. But it puts the individual always at the risk of becoming impulsive, irreverent, and thoughtless about ourselves and towards others, which is, again, the opposite of the Eastern mentality about gentleness and compassion for all things. So something to consider drawing more into your life. You don't necessarily have, like I said earlier, about throwing away technology and all that. I don't think that's necessary. But considering how you approach your life without being rash, I think is a good way of putting it.
You know, what's interesting about this to me, and one of the main reasons I wanted to do a show where we switch it up a little bit and we look at some of the Eastern mindsets, is because in the West right now, so much of what we see is a lot of people sitting in front of cable news and that cable news forming their reality. And when you talk to these people, it's almost like you're really not talking to that person anymore. You're getting the opinions and the mindsets that were projected from these constructs and all this concern. And in many cases, the concern is rooted in events that, in my view, didn't even take place in the first place. They were just designed and broadcast to have an effect on the minds, which they clearly are. And so for me, a lot of what we see in the Eastern teachings and a lot of the teachings will open up by saying, don't just take this for granted. Don't take it because we told you it's true. Challenge it. And if you find fault in it, then cast it aside. And to me, that's always been a very important thing. So I think that's the main point here. But I will also say we're at the top of the hour here, Jason. You and I and James were talking after the last show, and I think we started to talk a bit about a text called the Dhammapada, which is how we ended up deciding that we were going to go down this road today. For the average person who just wants, in a nutshell, to look at a little bit of the at one of the Eastern ideals, you could look up the PDF called the Dhammapada. And the very first thing out of the gate, as I mentioned earlier, is that the mind precedes all. For me, that has become almost an immutable truth. I suppose maybe something could happen in my existence that might add something I know right now that might change that. But for right now, it is one of the few things that is nearly fully acceptable to me because I've challenged it so profusely over the years. And that's how we began to go down this road. And I just started to think that, you know, if everybody considered, what does that mean? The mind precedes everything. Would it begin to combat what things like cable news and false news and television and lying governments and corporations gone wild? Would it begin to combat that? And in some ways, I think it would. But anyhow, we're at the top of the hour here, Jason. Is there anything you want to add before we take the break?
Well, in hour two, we're going to get into Lao Tzu and Taoism and a few other bits of the Eastern main points of Eastern philosophy. And then we're going to start comparing how these things may have been drawn into secret societies and some of those viewpoints.
Right. And there's a lot of sources that people can look up that probably demonstrate to my satisfaction, at least for the scope of this conversation, that almost certainly Freemasonry and any of the other secret societies, which I maintain are basically all in the same vein. I don't really think that there is much difference between any of the secret societies. I think their roots go back into this direction. And in some cases, you can flat out see where the claim is being made that Buddhism and Hinduism and maybe some older Indian belief systems are the direct roots that led into Freemasonry. And we're going to talk about that. And it should be an interesting conversation. Anyhow, that brings us to the top of the first hour for Crow 777 Radio, episode 51 with Jason Lindgren, examining the Eastern mindset and comparing and contrasting with how we live here in the West. Cheers. All right, man. Welcome back to the second hour of Crow 777 Radio Podcast. This is episode 51 with Jason Lindgren. We are examining the Eastern mindset and comparing and contrasting with how we live here in the West. And we're talking to membership now. And for anyone who would like to just get an encapsulated idea of the ideas we're expressing here, you could go look up the Dhammapada PDF online. It's a really, really easy read, but it's one of these texts where it's attributed to be very old. There's no telling how old is. I mean, how far does the world go back? I just don't know what to tell you there. Point is, it's very no-nonsense teachings that are supposed to have some age with them. And most of them you can logically break down and begin to challenge and see what you think. Another one, if you want to get a little further in and expend a little more brain cycle, is something like the Bhagavad Gita. I've read that a number of times, and it's very interesting read, but of course you got to put more effort into it. Anyhow, we're going to jump in with Lao Tzu, who was nearly a contemporary with Confucius, and I'll just let James pick up where we left off.
All right, so Lao Tzu is said to have been a record keeper in the court of the Central Chinese Zhou Dynasty in the 6th century BC. He was an older contemporary of Confucius. Again, there's no certainty if he was an actual historical figure just like the rest of these folks, but leaning towards the fact he may have been more just because I think there's some evidence of him. After tiring of life in the court, he was asked in his travels to write down his teachings. This became the Tao Te Ching, which probably a lot of folks have actually heard of. After this, he is said to have dropped out of history. Another theory is that his body of work is actually a collection of numerous philosophers' teachings passed down through generations in various Eastern schools. The character of Lao Tzu is the leading figure in what came to be known as Taoism. This school of thought is more than 2,000 years old, and it is still quite popular today.
Now, I meant to look this up as I was looking at the points. Is Tao Te Ching synonymous with I Ching?
No.
Okay, I was going to make the distinction there. I wasn't sure, but certainly we can talk a little bit about Taoism. Taoism seemed to really spread out across a lot of martial arts ideas, Kung Fu in China. There was a lot of Taoism mixed in with that, and it became the way. And then, of course, later on, I believe, Zen. I hope I have that timeline right. But anyhow, go ahead and keep pushing. I'm going to look up the I Ching while you're doing this so I can make the distinction.
Well, the I Ching is called the Classic of Changes. It's an ancient Chinese divination text and the oldest of the Chinese classics.
Got it.
So Taoism is a practice that embraces meditation as well as having their own pantheon of gods and goddesses. They also make pilgrimages to 5 sacred mountains in China, the purpose of which is to pray at the temples there and absorb spiritual energy. These places are believed to be governed by immortals. It is highly intertwined with other Eastern schools of thought, such as Confucianism and Buddhism. The difference with this philosophy is that the universe is sweet and guided by an unseen force called the Tao. That is spelled D-A-O. The Tao Te Ching gives ideas on how to live a good life, frequently open to interpretation. It is also called the Way of the World.
You know, this is interesting because here we have a conflicting viewpoint where the world is sweet, and it almost harkens to me a way to ages. Like if it really is true that there are ages and there was a golden age, if that's true, where would Buddhism ever find a foothold there? Where basically the whole idea behind Buddhism is to address the roots of suffering and to stop them somehow. If there truly was an age where things were great, it seems like Buddhism wouldn't have a place and something like this would, but that's just my observation here.
Well, the concept of the golden age, if you're referring to some of the other work we've done, gets into the time of when Saturn would have been the sun in the sky and all that. And if there's any reality to how long we've been here, that would have been thousands of years, I think, before the concept of Buddha, who was supposed to have lived from the 4th to 6th century BC, somewhere in there. I would think that this whole Saturnian golden age, if it did exist, would have been far, far earlier.
Right. But I mean, there's the old saying, nothing new under the sun. So even in Taoism, you know, we get these dates that are supposed real history, and you know how much of real history and real dates I accept. These ideas came from somewhere, almost almost to a study that I have done in Eastern religions, almost all of it is addressing the hardships of the world. And this on the face of it is nearly the opposing force, right? Where they're not really talking about suffering at all.
Right. And perhaps this is the rebuilding of humanity after some cataclysm as well. You know, that in the East, they refound teachings or started consolidating them because we really don't know what happened.
Right. We really don't know what happened. True.
Now, the interesting thing about Taoism that I noticed, for all you Star Wars fans out there, is I would say that this is where George Lucas drew heavily for the concept of the Force. A lot of these concepts that are in Star Wars seem to have drawn from this, but kind of made more tangible in the sense that all the things that Taoism talks about in Star Wars is just you can manifest it as a more physical reality with the power of the Force, but the concepts seem to be really close.
I never even really considered that. I had seen someone break down the roots of Jedi being a Jedi, but I hadn't considered that. It's interesting.
Well, Jedis are basically monks, if you think about it. So,
right.
With the meditation and connection to the universe and all that. So,
well, I hadn't looked at it for a while, but apparently the idea of Jedi was already in existence. And I think it relates to Judaism in some way, if I'm not mistaken. But again, I haven't looked at that in quite some time.
It just struck me when I was reading through all this yesterday that, wow, this sounds like, you know, Jedi Knights and the Force. But anyway, the way of the Tao is to learn what is called wu-wei, or wu-wei, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, flowing or effortless action. This, again, is why it reminded me of Star Wars. This could be said to be a purposeful acceptance of the way of the Tao and living in harmony with it. The suggestions on how to do this are as follows. We ought to make more time for stillness. To the mind that is still, the whole universe surrenders. Let go and experience the world. Nature happens on its own schedule without rushing, and yet all things are accomplished.
Yeah, you know, this is where it starts to get back to a commonality to the Eastern thought. In that first portion, you can really see how maybe practicing martial arts like Kung Fu, where, you know, flowing effortless action, you could see how it begins to really fit in real harmony with these ideas. But the stillness of the mind is a big part of almost all Eastern philosophies. And one of the best descriptions when I was young that I saw that got me looking at meditation and the idea that we didn't have control of our minds was a simple analogy that the average person right now walking the face of the earth is unaware that every time they take a breath, what they're thinking changes. Not only that, the average person is unaware that if you simply decide that you're going to try to think about nothing for 30 seconds, the average person will not be able to do it. The reason cited for this is the average mind right now is like boiling water in a pot where the surface is roiling and just all out of control boiling. And once you get that stillness in your mind, the top of that water becomes placid and calm, and it's a whole other way of being. And here again in the Taoism, we see it flowing back into this idea, having called the world sweet, not a place of suffering, but then again, back to the same idea of needing to harness our minds.
There's a couple of points there I want to go through. When you do this, when you still your mind, and I do meditate, you start becoming more aware, vastly so, of smaller details. So everyone's mind races. Mine races terribly. I have to focus just to have very straightforward conversations like this and make sure I stay on point, or else my mind will jump off to a million things. And I think a lot of people are like that. So even complete ding-dongs who you know aren't that bright, their minds still race just in different ways. So when you're doing this meditation and working towards this stillness, you start becoming more and more aware of smaller details, and that's what this is all about, is getting in touch and feeling the flow of the universe. The second point I would like to make on this is that you can see how these philosophies got immediately translated into the martial arts structures. Martial arts is never supposed to be used for attack. It should always be reactionary. And what that means is someone striking at you, you would never attack them first, and you are reacting to the universe. You're flowing with it and redirecting, more literally to the point that two very well in touch martial arts masters facing off against each other should literally just stand there staring at each other all day and without a strike ever being made.
You know, I saw a person in the Okinawan style of martial arts, which is pretty respected, talk about what karate meant to them. And they said, when you know you have the ability to defend yourself and your family, it really provides for you to live a much kinder life because it's not a concern. You're not afraid. You're not worried. You know you have this ability if you ever had to use it. So much so that if someone did have to defend themselves in that tradition and many others, you're not seeking to hurt them at all. You're just seeking to stop the infringement on your person or your family. So there's a lot of truth there.
Right. And I took Goshin Jitsu when I was younger. And let me see if I can remember the Goshin Jitsu creed. I haven't had to say this out loud in a while, but let's see if it's still in my memory. I come to you with only karate, empty hand. I have no weapons. But should I be forced to defend myself, my principles, or my honor, whether it be a matter of life or death, right or wrong, then here are my weapons. Karate. Empty hand.
You know, it's interesting. I've heard versions of that before, and I spent so much time in Okinawa when I was in the Marine Corps and learned about the Okinawan style of karate, which is highly respected all over the world, where the story being told was apparently, you know, they were coming under the aegises of one power or another, and laws were made that they couldn't have any weapons on Okinawa because they were being taken over, basically. So what they did is they took their farm implements, which is where we get things like nunchucks and other weapons that you would be familiar with in karate. And even in that, you see a real separation of a Western mindset and an Eastern mindset. Can you imagine if someone came into a Western area and said, all right, you guys can't have weapons anymore? Can you imagine the farm implements being the things that are carefully molded into a new martial art, you know, as a means to defend yourself? It's a very, very interesting thing to examine.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And you can imagine that taking these philosophies, how it got channeled into being a physical thing, you know, and it's very evident in the fighting styles, just even what little I know. But next up, we have the importance of emptiness. Empty yourself of everything. Let your mind be still. We need to be in touch with our real selves. Instead of worrying so much about who we want to become, we should take more time to consider who we already are at heart. The ego may be in the way of our true self.
You know, to me, as you were reading that again, and the first time that I saw it, it really makes me think of the false news cycles, where what's going on here is all this false news and this fear and this fear porn are really seeking to do away with emptying yourself of everything, to have that calm placidness, to just do damage to these concepts that we're talking about now, where you're being filled up with concern and the threats of violence and terrorism and nuclear explosions and war with this country or that country. And when you contrast what we see in our Western life and we begin to think about what you just talked about, there's some real important things the average person could gain here. You know, as an example, I don't watch any news ever. And all these people have been commenting on the supposed problem we're going to have with Russia or these other things that I know nothing about. And it's interesting to me because as they're saying them, I have no concern in my being for war with any country. I could care less, or Syria or these other things people are talking about. And I wonder what the effect would be across large portions of people if they were acting as I did now, where they could care less what the news was pushing. Would it actually serve to defuse some of the nonsense the news is pushing? Or it's a hard thing to know, but I had to make that observation.
Yeah, absolutely. The last part of this to tie that up is, when I let go of who I am, I become what I might be.
What's the old saying? A person is actually three people. They're who they think they are, who others think they are, and who they really are.
Next up, we have the best people are like water, which benefits all things and does not compete with them. It stays in lowly places that others reject. This is why it is so similar to the Tao.
I think Bruce Lee made a run at a version of that, actually, in an old one of his old clips. But anyhow, go ahead, keep pushing.
In a world full of constant changes and in-your-face situations, the reminder for the need for stillness is extremely important in the Western mindset. Because basically, let's think about this for just a moment. We are being bombarded constantly. iPhones, television, advertisements. You can't walk down the street without being hit with just God knows what. The whole point here is you do need to take time to still the mind and unplug, maybe is a good way of putting it, detach. Like, you need to take time for yourself, get away from all of this distraction, and just quiet your mind and get in touch with more of who you really are.
You know, this is an important idea, the idea of stilling the mind. And the average person can start to do it. It does take, you know, you have to work at it. And once you start to get there, if you quit doing it, you'll slide back to where you were, I think, for most people, and you'll have to start over, although you will have a path because you've been there before. But it's a bit like your mind is constantly in a marathon that never gets a break. And when the first time you still your mind, it's like almost understanding true rest for a short period of time. It's really regenerating in a way. And I would suggest to people, you know, the idea of the earworm in the West. How many times have you woke up or found yourself in a day with a song in your head that you can't get rid of? This is a perfect example. You see, if you can still your mind, you could get rid of that song instantly. But in the West, what most of us do is we'll start thinking of a different song, almost like we're trying to combat fire with fire. You know, I've got this song stuck in my head that I really don't want there. I didn't put it there. I don't know how it got there. I can't seem to turn it off, so I'll start humming this other song to try to get rid of it. Well, this idea of stilling the mind is truly a way to get rid of it, because there is some reality to the fact that we don't control portions of our mind, whether you want to call it subconscious. I don't even know how to address that. But when you begin to learn to still your mind, it really does open up a lot of doors that you may not have been aware of previous.
Absolutely. And even in the few minutes we took on a break between recording hour one and hour two, I went outside for 10 minutes, sat on my porch in the beautiful warm sun, and did nothing, just to let my mind clear for a moment, refocus, and just feel the beautiful warmth hitting my body, and just cleared my mind, came back in. I felt refreshed to go on to hour two. It's little things like this that I would highly suggest to folks to do during the day, every day, to just make yourself feel a little bit better.
That's right. And even self-reflection, you know, right before Jason and I began this recording, I was dealing with an insurance company, and what they're doing is unconscionable. And I told Jason as we sat down, man, my mind's not in the best place to start doing this. But you see, being aware of all these things we're talking about, I was already self-reflecting, trying to dial myself back, thinking about the things I'd said and done in that call that was very stressful with an insurance company, and reassessing how I should have handled it, how I could have handled it better. So there's a lot to this idea of having some modicum of control and being able to still your mind and have self-reflection.
Next up, we're going to discuss the concept of Wu Wei, non-doing or doing nothing. This is at the heart of following Tao, or the Way. In the central text of Taoism is the Tao Te Ching. The way never acts, yet nothing is left undone. This is the paradox of Wu Wei. It doesn't mean not acting. It means effortless action or actionless action. It is the notion to be swimming with instead of against the currents of the universe. It definitely means to put ego aside.
To me, this really speaks directly to a human being's ability to recognize that we are in a system called nature. And as was stated earlier in this set of ideas, nature moves at its own pace, yet nothing is left undone. I think that's really what's being addressed here in my mind, is that as people, we get an ego, like we can control nature. We're humans. We're the pinnacle of everything. We can do all these things and make things go our way. Yet the idea being expressed here is if we just stop and observe and try to become more of the system within which we live, there's real benefit. So that's the idea for me.
All right. Next up, we have the character of Sen no Rikyu. Again, sorry if I'm butchering these names. I'm not very good with them. He is supposed to have been born in 1522 in the wealthy seaport of Sakai, which is near the present-day city of Osaka on the Japanese island of Honshu. He is known for his contributions that he made to reform and the appreciation of Chanoyu, the Japanese tea ceremony. This word literally means hot water for tea. The Japanese had been drinking tea since the 9th century, practice that was imported from China. Drinking tea was considered healthy, calming, and spiritual.
You know, the average person that's never seen a Japanese tea ceremony, you should watch it, because it is so foreign to the Western mindset. The average person won't be able to watch the whole tea ceremony. And when they see things like how many turns the glass gets, how many motions are in the whisking of the tea, the just complete and utter ceremonial precepts put down around making something as, you know, monotonous as tea, it's a real study in mindsets. They've even got little tea houses and gardens that are put up, and the time of year, all these things play into simply making a cup of tea. And I think it's a real contrast between Eastern and Western mindsets.
Absolutely. Big difference between a Japanese tea house and a Starbucks.
Yeah. God, night and day, man, above and below, I would say.
So he prompted an alternative set of values to the more monetary and materialistic views of the Japan of his time. He called this wabi-sabi, a compound word meaning satisfaction with simplicity and austerity, but with an appreciation of the imperfect.
You know, I think the first time I was ever exposed to the idea of wabi-sabi was in connection to some of the Zen gardens around temples and other places, listening to people explain what could be gained from that landscape and why the landscape was there. And what it basically comes down to my Western mind, is subtlety and recognizing that the essence of a thing can actually be appreciated and named in some way, where in the West, most times we don't look at the essence of a thing in that way. I would invite the average person to go look up wabi-sabi and try to get a sense of what's being expressed here, because it really is kind of a foreign idea to the Western mind.
Yeah, absolutely. So he pushed for changes to the Japanese tea houses of the time that were grand buildings that held many people, and instead changed them to tiny buildings with doors intentionally made a little too small, so that no matter who was crossing the threshold had to bow, setting everyone as equals. The idea was also to create a barrier between the tea house and the world outside, with the path leading to the tea house passing around stones, rivers, grass, you know, just basically a little walk through nature, to create a meander that would help break ties with the ordinary realm. A properly performed tea ceremony was meant to promote what he termed as wa, meaning harmony, which would emerge as participants rediscovered their connections to nature. During their time at the ceremony, one may come to an emotion known as kai, meaning respect. A successful ceremony was to leave its participants with a feeling of jaku, which means tranquility, and sai, which means purity. These were central concepts in Raikou's gentle, calming philosophy. He also pushed that there was no need for expensive implements to make the tea, but rather simply made items that very well may have been very old and worn and all that. This was really actually considered very important and a manner of respect. All of this is a representation also of the philosophies of Zen.
Right. So, I mean, what we're looking at here is basically a cup of tea becoming a form of meditation in a big way. And the idea of wa, you know, for those of you who may have read some of old Clavell's books, when I was younger, I read all Clavell's books, I think in my 20s. Shogun is a good example where they're demonstrating that a household in Japan would have a thing called wa. And if someone got pissed off and made a scene inside a household, then they were destroying that wall, and that was a punishable offense. But what's interesting about this tea ceremony is in some of the Japanese traditions that I've been familiar with, and I did spend a couple years in Japan, is if you're the person doing the tea ceremony and you screw up some portion of it, there's like this horrible shame and, you know, sense of failure that comes on you. So it was like this weird double-edged sword where they were taking something as mundane as a cup of tea and raising it to this like elaborate meditation art form. But at the same time, if you screwed that up, then you would wish you were dead just about. So it's really a strange contrast in opposite ways of thinking from the Western mindset.
Well, what I took away from the concept of the tea ceremony is that it's basically a mass guided meditation.
Right.
So you're really reflecting with each other. You know, yes, there's one person guiding the meditation, and it's just the tea, the drinking of the tea, the making of the tea and the drinking of the tea is just sort of window dressing, really, for a togetherness sort of thing, you know?
There's even plenty of examples in books that I've read where a couple, a Japanese couple, might be having trouble, and they turn to the tea ceremony to try to put together the relationship if it's possible. And you just nailed some of the key aspects here, because they want to reach kai, which is respect, a feeling of jaku, which means, you know, tranquility, sai, which means purity. I mean, if you nailed every portion of this meditation form called the tea ceremony in the Eastern Japanese mindset, that might be enough to fix the problems in a relationship even. So it's very, very interesting ideas to think about and to know something about.
Of course, because relationships, when they start having problems, it's usually because of heated emotions. So if you're taking the time to do a togetherness kind of thing like this, where you are stilling the mind and you're doing it together, hopefully the notion of mutual respect and understanding might return to the relationship.
Right. Quite often on the tail of a successful Japanese tea ceremony in this method, you will find the person who was being served the tea saying they were in awe of how the person performing the ceremony pulled it off. And they literally are exuding respect and all these things that are being addressed in this. So it's an interesting thing to think about how such a mundane action to us. I mean, what do we do in the West? We put on a pot, we boil some water, we make some tea, we drink it, and we really never think too much more beyond that. And here we're looking at such a mundane task in the West, just kind of elevated, and it's all because of what's in your mind. It's mind preceding everything. It's an interesting thing to understand.
Now, I've never experienced this, but you've been to Japan, so what did you take away from it?
When I first got there, the real contrast for me was kind of the brashness of mostly male Marines being in a place like Okinawa. And you've got to realize that Okinawa is much more laid back than mainland Japan. And I don't think they identify as even the same race, or for lack of a better terms. They differentiate themselves as not necessarily Japanese in the same Japanese way. And they do look a little different. But as you begin to see these things, it really had a profound effect on me, particularly looking at the martial arts and the other things that the Okinawans had developed. But when I began to look around, I began to realize in Okinawa how old a lot of those people were getting, over 100, you know, some of them close to 115, 20 years old. And we were seeing people that were like 90 going out to tend their gardens every day as if they were like 60. And this is really when I began to look very carefully at how are these people so different. And it's across the board, not only what they're eating, but how their minds are working, what they're doing in a day, how they treat family. I mean, it is all so vastly different than we are here in the West.
Did you partake in a tea ceremony?
No. As a matter of fact, I've never seen a live tea ceremony, but I have seen filmed versions of it many, many times.
All right. Up next, we have Matsuo Basho. In the 17th century, there was a Japanese Buddhist monk who was also a poet. The poetry he wrote, which is the idea behind Eastern poetry in general, is to guide us to wisdom and calmness, as these terms are defined in Zen Buddhist philosophy. His poems were written in the haiku style, which I'm sure a lot of folks have heard of. They contain three parts, two images, and a concluding line. The concluding line helps to juxtapose the images.
Yeah, and again, what you're looking at here is subtlety. When we look at Western prose or poetry, there are versions that might be comparable, but really to me, it's subtlety. It's almost like the hidden or double meanings and other things. Not only that, but that it conformed to the architecture that's required to be called haiku. It's really quite a intricate thing.
Now, the most well-known haiku in Japanese literature was written by Matsuo Basho, and it is called Old Pond, and here it is as follows. Old pond, a frog leaps in, waters sound. And that's it. I mean, this is very straightforward. But if you're imagining these things, I think there's a lot to do with visualization and reflection in these things, because I read several of these of his works.
Well, a lot of the Japanese art, literature, and other things are so closely tied to nature. And again, that contrasts with our Western tradition. In the West, we are pretty separated from nature, most of us at this point. And so for us to read Old Pond, a frog leaps in, water sound, that wouldn't rise to a poem for most of us. And yet here we are looking in the Japanese culture where this is held in very like top regard, these few lines. And it really starts to show the purpose of this episode.
You can also, by reading a poem like that, you can see just how different the mindset is from Eastern to Western.
That's the whole bag of nuts here. We really, in the West, we don't have the tradition or the longevity of a lot of nations around us. And in terms of even understanding two or three generations back for a lot of us in the West isn't really possible. And so we can really learn something from these other traditions. And a lot of it comes down to appreciating nature, to respecting all things as you would respect yourself, and to understand subtlety. And I think the understanding of subtlety is one of the main things that gets lost in the Western mindset.
Yeah, because we're constantly being bombarded and everything's fast-paced and just go, go, go.
Yeah, materialism. It's counterproductive in some ways, in a lot of ways.
Now, Matsuo Bushō didn't believe in the modern idea of art for art's sake. He hoped that his poetry would bring his readers into special mental states that are valued in Zen Buddhism. So basically, it's a continuation of the philosophy and the practices that they follow. His poetry reflects two of the most important Zen ideals. Once again, we're talking about wabi-sabi. It was nature that was considered over all other things to foster the ideas of wabi and sabi. It is therefore unsurprisingly that this was one of his most frequent topics of writing.
Well, you know, there's a real logic to me in this idea to hold so closely to nature, because you see, nature, however it got here, whatever it is in fact the system we live within. And some of the sayings that we've read here in this episode, where nature never rushes, yet it gets all things done, these are true things. And so maybe there is an inherent value to try to pull back from the artificial, the man-made, and to get more in touch with whatever that crane is doing in the field, whatever that frog is doing in the pond, and begin to reflect in that way, because in some sense, these systems that these things we can observe are living in is in fact where we are living too, except our mind has pulled us away into this artificial, man-made environment.
And I think it's kind of obvious when you start looking at these things, just how much of a trap it is. That's definitely what I took away from it. And I'm generally more open-minded than most people I encounter. But even just stepping back and really looking at these very boiled down, simple philosophies, you realize that the world we're living in Western society, it's, man, they've got us chained bad.
We're in dire straits right now, but the real question in my mind becomes, are we truly in cycles? Where we find ourselves now, is it just like at the low point of a wheel turning and now we're ascending the wheel? I tend to think that's probably correct. I don't have any way to know that for certain. Or is it more we really need to recognize where we've gotten to and begin to address it? And I think it's a little bit of both. I think it's critical for people to understand where we are simply because it gives them the opportunity to change their minds. And let me tell you something. The biggest benefits in my lifetime have come from conscious mind shifts, and it's done a lot for me in being happy in my daily life. As an example, there may have been a time I have a friend here who's big into birds. He does world-class bird photography. His stuff is all over bird feeder companies stuff. He draws them birds. And I remember at one point he was telling me about how the damn raccoons were getting into the bird's nest and killing the poor bird's eggs, and therefore the raccoons were the enemy. And the squirrels weren't much better either, because they were always trying to steal all the birds' food. And way back when I first heard this, I didn't think anything about it. All these years later, when I think about these ideas, what I consider is, how is the raccoon any different from the bird? He's here to do what he's here to do. He's not doing something alien. He's doing what raccoons are do. And it has helped me to accept things that are vastly different from myself, understanding that I'm not the judge, jury, and executioner here. And when I look at things that I might not necessarily think are good out of the gate, like a raccoon stealing birds' eggs, the point is the raccoon is here in this system, and he's simply doing what a raccoon is here to do. And there is a freedom in this way of thinking, in a way.
Well, this again would be the whole going with the flow. This is all part of nature, and nature will do what it needs to do.
Well, no doubt. I mean, you get to the point where the raccoon is being trapped and taken out behind the shed and shot in the head because he's interfering with the birds. And, you know, I recognize this now for Ego, you know, the human deciding that that raccoon shouldn't be doing what a raccoon does, and I can intervene here and change it. And that's really where you begin to let go, where you're not so interested in trying to exert your human abilities to change everything, and you become more of the system where you're observing it instead of trying to affect it.
I would suggest that is ego.
It's absolutely ego. It's a number of things. But at the root of it, in my view, it's your separation from the system within that we're all subject to. And it's a bit like getting caught in a riptide and being that person who tries to swim feverishly against the riptide until they're exhausted and at the risk of drowning. And another person who understands that a riptide's going to do what a riptide's going to do, and just letting the current take you. And even if it takes you a mile out, you're still alive and you swim back in. It's a good analogy because there's a lot of that in it.
Absolutely. Now, Matsuo Basho also liked to paint as well as write, and frequently there would be a relevant haiku written beside his paintings. Many of his works are actually still in existence today and on display. In literature, he valued karumi, which means lightness. He wanted the written works to seem as if children had written it and abhorred pretension and elaboration. He believed that poetry could, at its best, allow one to feel a brief sensation of merging with nature. The idea is to reach an enlightened state of mind through the words known as muga, which means loss of awareness of oneself. This is in very stark contrast to the Western thinking of extreme unique individuality to stand out against the rest of the world. Muga is valuable because it allows us to break free from the incessant thrum for desire and incompleteness that which otherwise haunts all human lives every day. We must escape, if only temporarily, the tyranny of being ourselves.
So if Muga was one of the predominant things here in the West, I guess we would lose fashion for the most part. Makeup from the female perspective, you know, the macho-ness from the male perspective, all these things would begin to melt away, wouldn't they?
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting, and I'm very much for the concept of individuality. I do not like homogenization. That's why even in the military, you're wearing what's called a uniform, so that you're all the same. So
right.
I'm for that. However, I definitely love this concept of being able to step back from that. I think that's what this is all about. It's not that don't be yourself, but be able to step back from yourself. Again, this all kind of comes down to the whole letting go of the ego thing and just take a break. Feel at one with things and reset yourself so that you can get back to doing what you need to do.
Right. To me, it kind of is the same analogy as the rip current, whether you swim against it and risk drowning or whether you let it take you. In defining who you are as a person, most people in the West, I think, would take that as, okay, I got to choose a look. I got to choose how I dress. I got to choose all these things. In this idea, it's more like, just let me become who I'm going to be. Don't plan to dress. Don't plan to do all these things. Just let the current take me and I will be what I am.
Right, exactly. Now, there's two more points about Eastern philosophy we were going to go through before we get into how the secret societies may have used some of these concepts. The first one is in Japanese philosophy and Zen Buddhism regarding ceramics, there's a concept called kintsugi, which means to join with gold. And the idea here is that you embrace the flaws and accidents of time because the one constant is that everything is a change. Everything changes, all things happen. Nothing lasts forever. So a ceramic cup, a pot, or anything like that that was damaged should be repaired with lacquer and the lines of the repair joints emblazoned with gold to accent the repairs. No attempt should ever be made to hide the damage. The idea is to emphasize that breaks have a philosophical merit all their own.
So this is the complete counterpart of the idea of mass production, where you burn out all these things. Each one is perfect. Each one is like the last one. That is an artificial construct. That is an unnatural construct, what the industrial age has brought us. And here you see the actual recognition of one of the very most foundational truths that I hold that inform me that we are in fact living in illusion. The way that I got there is very closely based on this idea of the ceramics that Jason just outlined. When I began to examine the world around me, to try to discover if it was an illusion. The way I got there was because of the impermanence and change that is unarguable. If I look at a rock and I call it a rock, I'm implying that it is this and it will always be this. But you see, that's not true. And we can prove this. Every second that goes by, everything in our existence is changing and becoming something else. So actually, to call this thing a rock is not correct in the first place. It's something different than every other thing we call a rock. And 2 seconds ago, it was a different rock than it is now. And when I began to further break this down, I began to understand that every second that I exist is different and change has occurred, which almost means, to make some kind of weak analogy, it's almost like looking at a flipbook animation, where I look at the whole animation and I say this is a whole thing, when in fact it's not a whole thing. It's just little snapshots that went by in a second and then something else was there. And that's how I began to discover that this is in fact an illusion. And I think this set of values built up around imperfection in ceramics illustrates the idea perfectly, and thereby puts the importance of why I think we should all look at the ideas we're putting forth here. Because there's a chance one of them will resonate with someone out there and they will begin to look more deeply and maybe get to some foundational truths.
Now, this really struck at my heart because I came up with a concept that I termed years ago called disposable society, because that's what we live in. I mean, it's literally down to the cups and forks and things that we throw away, to relationships. People don't work on fixing relationships anymore. They throw it away and start all over again instead of, you know, maybe your grandparents or great-grandparents in their day, they would actually try to fix something. And I think that's incredibly important. I mean, it's why a lot of people are miserable, because no one's perfect. You know, it's always that grass is greener on the other side concept. You know, instead of actually trying to work on something, as soon as something goes wrong, you just discard it and just go get another one. And I think that's a huge problem today.
So there it is, man. It's our culture being mentally, foundationally changed by things like mass production. Well, why do I got to care about this cup? There's 1,000 more exactly like it. And by the way, this one costs 50 cents at Walmart. That does have a foundational effect on psyche. And that is the real importance of examining Eastern and other philosophies, where there is a whole different mindset going on now. Although I suppose it could be argued, you know, these old ideas we're talking about here, where are they in the modern Eastern mind? I don't know how to address that, but you make a valid point. How the systems that we choose to follow, which in the West are primarily synthetic and man-made, have foundational effect on our psyches. And unfortunately, I suspect the further that we get from nature as a system that we know was here, that we know works, that we know, I guess, was designed to do what it does, the further we get from that, the more alienated from ourselves we become.
I don't know how many people actually hear the words we're speaking right now, whether it's in the hundreds or in the thousands or tens of thousands. But if anyone takes anything away from what we're going through here, I would definitely say look at your relationships and don't squander it. Don't just throw things away because one problem comes up. And that's what all of this is about. It's about self-reflection. It's about maybe there's things of value here that shouldn't just be discarded.
Well, mostly in a Western mindset, when something goes wrong, we tend to look outside of ourselves and say, who caused this that's not me, or what caused this that's not me? And a lot of these Eastern ideas, the exact opposite would be true. This thing has gone wrong. Was I a part of making it go wrong? You know, so it's truly how you view a thing in the context that you use in some ways dictates the value you're going to get out of the assessment you try to make.
Absolutely. And I'm speaking from personal experience as well, that, you know, these things can have lasting damage and you may not even realize it in your lives. So anyway, the last point we want to talk about here is the notion that wisdom may come from somewhere other than just reading a book. And the concept here is that rocks have wisdom to teach. This whole concept of venerating rocks started in China, but it crossed over to Japan. And it's rocks of various kinds that are held in deep reverence. Basically, kind of what you said before, where the rock changes from point to point in time. You know, it's not the same as it was 5 seconds ago. And this led to rock gardens and all that sort of thing. And, you know, it's not supposed to be just something pretty to look at. It's something to be looked at and learned from.
Right. And there's, I mean, you could go on for quite a while in this, you know, because most of us view rocks as more of a permanent thing. In other words, this rock's going to look pretty much like it does now long after I'm gone. So this rock has a permanence I do not. But you see, looking at it in this way tips that on its head, you see, because it's not accepting the rock as some kind of a permanent thing that's going to hold its nowness forever, because it's not. That's what's being recognized. And again, it is understanding that we live within a system that does what it does, not to hearken to the Matrix, but you know what she say, at some point someone wrote a program for those crows, so the crows are going to do what the crows are going to do. Not that I'm suggesting we're in the Matrix, I don't know where we are, but I do know that nature does what it does, and all things get done within that system. So if we observe it, we see the very place that surrounds us doing what it does, but are we a part of that? Are we learning from that? Or have we gone off and completely constructed this other illusion? And I would suggest that in the West, a lot of what we're following is hardcore illusion, because it's synthetic, it's man-made, and it lacks value, a lot of it. And we've pointed that out in places. And I'm not trying to point out that an Eastern way is better than a Western way. What I'm trying to point out is that there is not a significant culture in this world that does not have something to teach us. And part of what we've lost in the modern age is travel, for one. You know, when I was younger, people traveled a heck of a lot more. And, you know, travel, as Mark Twain put it, is in fact fatal to bigotry. And I forget exactly how that quote goes, but when you go to a place and you learn about that place and you meet the people of that place, it's not as easy for Fox News or CNN to come along and say, see, these are Muslims, they're the enemy. You see, because you've met them, you've been there, you've seen the culture, and that's really at the basis of what we're talking about here. But anyhow, we were going to have James with us, but unfortunately he wasn't able to make it, and he submitted some of his notes, and they had directly to do with Masonic roots in these Eastern ideas, so that's where we're going to jump in now.
Right. Here we have Masonic references in respect to the concept of enlightenment. Masonry considers light to be the equivalent to that of Eastern enlightenment. Speculative Masonry considers Freemasons to be the sons of light. They alone are entitled to be in true possession of the true meaning of light. The profane, which is all the rest of us, are not privy to this entitlement and in turn are said to be in the arena of the debasing worship of darkness.
So now you begin to see right out of the gate the corruption of Masonic ideas. If you were to go into, say, Tibetan Buddhism and take the idea of light or enlightenment, which is exactly what Masonry is talking about here, there are things called bodhisattvas in that tradition. And this is in the Mahayana tradition, not the Hinayana tradition. In the Mahayana Tibetan Buddhism tradition, a person may be said to have reached the point where they could go to enlightenment if they so chose and end the cycle of life and death and just become an enlightened being. Yet as a bodhisattva, they take a vow recognizing that every living being here is suffering and stuck where they were previously stuck. Therefore, they vow to not go to enlightenment, but to stay here to try to help every living being out. It's a bit like saying, I could become enlightened tomorrow, but I'll be here forever because I know the odds of me helping everyone out of here is nearly impossible. But it is such an act of compassion that is revered as, you know, as high as many things are. And here in the Masonic, this watered down kind of corrupted idea. In my view, we see them saying, we're the only ones who can hold the light and everyone else is in the darkness. So it flies in the face of the very roots of the teaching they took it from, in my view.
Continuing on from that, darkness is the symbol of a state of preparation or the anti-mundane chaos from whence light issues at the divine command. The adept exists in a state of darkness before becoming the initiate of the light. Now, this is where a lot of this whole Lucifer thing gets tied in as well, where illumination and knowledge are kind of meaning the same thing. And we happen to know from people who have spilled the beans about Freemasonry, especially Scottish Rite is more what I'm getting at, is that you find out once you hit the 30th degree that the blood oaths you've been swearing since you were a porch mason are to Lucifer. And that's who you are, if you want to put it in this term, worshiping. So you are enlightened. You have knowledge, and the rest of us, the ones who are not part of the Brotherhood, are the profane or the ignorant, or we are not in the light.
It's a strange, strange thing, man. You know, when I did the other shows on Freemasonry and I pointed out that basically all the lower level Masons were being lied to and used, and that in the whole of England, there were only three guys at a high enough level to start to understand the reality of what they were doing and encoding and all these other things. To me, that is a lopsided, corrupted system. It is either true that we are all human beings, and if you want to take that larger, that we are all living beings, and that as a living being here in this system, you should be afforded some form of respect, or that's not true. And when I look at these things and these ideas that have come out of Masonry, all I can say at this point, from my point of view, is that to be a Mason is to be a fool professed. You can see where the roots of these things came from, and yet they don't resemble in many ways the very provenance that they came from, these ideas that were held for everyone. If you were alive, you were entitled, basically, to this other thing where it's this militaristic hierarchy, and we can see it being used against the whole world to corrupt minds, to purvey false news. So it's just, I don't understand on the face of it how it could even have come to have been this, knowing that the roots were more compassionate, more all-encompassing of all living beings into this perverted thing it seems to be now. I just don't understand it.
Now, it's interesting about these higher rankings in Freemasonry. To be a Shriner, for instance, you cannot be considered for such if you're not a 32nd degree of the Scottish Rite. So you're well aware by the time you would go into the whole Shriner thing, and they're very well known for charity and all that. You're already kind of aware of what Freemasonry had been about in your career as a Freemason by the time you would go to become a Shriner. So that's just an interesting thing to think about. And of course, there's a lot of things people have uncovered that the money doesn't necessarily always go to the charities. The other thing I would suggest is that the 33rd degree has been said to be an honorary degree, and that you have the only way you get it is if you are doing something towards the contribution of the great work. And the definition of the great work has been said to be different things, but one of the things I've noticed cropped up a lot is that the great work is Novus Ordo Seclorum, which is Latin for New Order of the Ages, or a New World Order. And, you know, who knows exactly if this stuff is accurate or not, but this is what seems to keep coming out from people who had been in Freemasonry and just didn't like the way it was going. I would suggest, though, the people that we do know to be 33rd degree Freemasons aren't exactly the most honest people. Buzz Aldrin and Walt Disney come to mind.
Well, or any number of presidents or politicians, and so on the face of it, you can see it for what it is. I mean, if there was milk at a point, you're looking at oil being poured into the milk, aren't you? It's not really an arguable point. And so as a almost religious endeavor, which I don't know if you could really consider Masonry a religious endeavor, but as a way of furthering your pursuits as a human being in some way, to me, it's not the way that I would choose to go. I would be more interested in being beneficial to all living beings. And what I see from these guys is the exact opposite, if it's a correct assessment, I guess.
Right. Now, up next on James's points are, the ancient religions believed light to be the symbol of sight, a source of knowledge and goodness. Darkness, in contrast, was synonymous with evil, ignorance, and fear. And you can see how that would tie right in with the Freemasonry points of view.
Right. I mean, even in the Dhammapada I mentioned earlier, there are experts, excerpts, and I can't quote it directly from memory, but the idea is to be in darkness and to realize the light is no different than being on a moonless, pitch black night when a sudden flash of lightning illuminates everything around you. So this idea is threaded through so many traditions, and there's really no arguing with it. I mean, if you are on a dark night and you can't see a thing and lightning flashes, there is illumination there. So it is an allegory for this thing that they're driving at. But again, it seems to me that the use of it in the Masonic tradition here is corruption. That's my assessment.
The next point James wanted to contribute is that in the Brahmins Bhagavad Gita, it is said that light and darkness are esteemed the world's eternal ways. He who walketh in the former path returneth not. That is, he goeth immediately to bliss, whilst he who walketh in the ladder cometh back again upon the earth.
So if the roots of Masonry go back into these Indian traditions like the Bhagavad Gita, what they're saying here is there's two paths, a light path and a dark path. It's even echoed in the song Stairway to Heaven. If you're on the light path, you can escape the suffering that is this world and have no fear of being recycled back here, if that is a true thing. I'm not saying that it is. I'm saying if that is a true thing. On the flip side, if you're on the dark path, you're not leaving here. You're coming back and you're going to be in the cycle of suffering. So you see, again, you see my problem with the idea of what Masonry has done, because they're lying to all the lower people, which is the dark path, which is basically saying us upper guys have the light and we have some chance of escaping what's going on here. Well, you guys do not, unless you make it up to where we are. But like I said, in England in the 1800s, there were three dudes at the top. And in my view, I don't think I would call the path they were on light at all. None of it rings true. It all seems very corrupted to me. If it is true there are two paths, and if it is true Masonry owns its roots to these sources, what the heck are they doing, man? That's all I would ask.
It's interesting that you've brought up Stairway to Heaven twice now. That is from the Led Zeppelin 4 album, and by that point, those guys were studying Aleister Crowley works and a bunch of other dark stuff, and
it's stamped on the center of the album. Crowley's Maxim is stamped on the center of that LP.
So these guys knew what they were weaving into their songs, and the two paths are the right path of light and the left hand path of darkness. And you see in Satanism and black magic and all that, whatever you want to call it, the left hand path, and that is the path of darkness.
Right. And even in the Stairway to Heaven usage, it's almost like they're imploring you to get back to the right path. Yes, there are two paths you may go down, but in the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on. In my view, that's a bit like saying, yeah, there's a dark path and a light path, but you can still get off the dark path if you try. It's a very, very strange thing to see people seemingly treading the dark path, but constantly tipping their hand in this way.
If I had to sum that song up, I would say it's really about self-reflection and trying to make the right decision.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to know. I guess it's point of views. It would be hard to know what whoever put those words down was thinking when they put them down. What we're told is Robert Plant did it in about 10 minutes, but who knows what the truth may be.
Well, I mean, he may have if he had it in mind and was already studying different magical philosophies. May have already been very familiar to him, you know?
I don't know. It's just I've learned so much about what's gone on that I just can't put value in these things anymore. I just can't do it. They're constructs. They're man-made. They're corruptions, and they're made to pull us away from what we can truly observe and hopefully do a little bit better than we were yesterday.
Right. So next up with James's notes, we have the Pythagoreans called the light the one. Unity, the right hand, equality, stability, and a straight line. The darkness was binary, the left hand, inequality, instability, and a curved line. So the Pythagoreans, we're talking about a long time ago in ancient Greece.
Yeah, if there was such a time, and again, we see absolute ties into Masonry here, but that was the point of what James did. It's a bit like, I've said this a lot of times, as far as I can tell, what Aleister Crowley did was go around the world and try to learn as much as he could about existing traditions. Then he took what he considered workable portions of those teachings and he stripped away all concern of compassion or any developing into a higher, more compassionate religious type nature. And he just took the nuts and bolts of it to accomplish whatever the hell it was he wanted to accomplish. And that's a little bit like what's reflected here. But again, I could absolutely show you the exact opposite idea. As an example, some of the Eastern gardens around monasteries and temples have curved paths. Well, here the darkness is the binary, the left hand, and the inequality is through, and the curved line. Well, the idea in those traditions is those curved paths are to make it so demons can't get you, because demons can only travel in straight lines. So it's really some opposing ideas here, the deeper you look.
Next up, we have the Kabbalists believed that before the creation of the world, all space was filled with infinite intellectual light, which afterwards withdrew itself to an equal distance from a central point in space, and afterwards, by its emanation, produced future worlds. The first emanation of the surrounding light into the abyss of darkness produced what they called the Adam Kadmon, the first man, or the first production of the divine energy.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what to do with this. I've read a lot about Kabbalah, and it seems like it's such an inside line thing, and it almost seems to me like, or at least where I was left with the feeling, if you didn't speak Hebrew, you really weren't going to be able to get that far into it, because it all seemed encoded.
All right, up next we have the Masons and other esoteric mystery cults cultivated the idea of Buddhist enlightenment, to which Buddha believed all were party to, regardless of class, age, gender, and societal creed, to be privy to the select minority only. So basically, the Freemasons are all about the knowledge is for us and us alone. If you're not part of the Brotherhood, that, you know, be damned.
Well, it flies in the face of its root in Buddhism, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You see, because Buddhist teaches that there are no castes, that all living things are equal, even a duck. You don't kill a duck because it's a living being and it has as much right to live as you do. That's a Buddhist teaching. As a matter of fact, they even put the kind of sin, the Eastern sin idea, where if you do kill that duck, it's going to affect you in negative ways later on down the road because you shouldn't be killing that duck. That's the idea behind it. But, you know, there's masonry coming from Buddhism clearly and saying, by the way, you know, us guys at the top, we're really the only ones who are allowed to have this good information.
Right. And James's last point is, only through the process of illumination can the profane become the sacred. In the mysteries, the candidate passed during his initiation through scenes of utter darkness and at length terminated his trials by an admission to the splendidly illuminated shrine, where he was said to have attained pure and perfect light, and where he received the necessary instructions which were to invest him with that knowledge of the divine truths which had been object of all his labors.
You know, that it kind of encapsulates so much of what we've been talking here. This last portion James submitted because we were going to have him on and in a more deep way address the roots of Masonry. But in these bullet points, I feel like he did a pretty good idea of showing. And to me, this is the whole purpose for examining the Eastern mindset, because in my mind, modern Masonry is almost established and brought forward in the Western mindset, where the very things it came from, like Buddhism and Hinduism and ancient Eastern traditions, were brought up in an Eastern mindset. And I have researched plenty of accounts where the claim is that while Buddhism came from these Eastern sources, they were prevented from getting the whole enchilada because the Eastern masters recognized the profanity that was coming out of things like Masonry. I can't tell you if these things are true, but man, it would sure answer a lot of questions if it was. But that does bring us to the top of the second hour, and I hope this kind of change of pace was helpful for some people. We'll be back on track next week, but I wanted to kind of take a break from beating to death just how dark things have gotten around us and maybe give people a path to look at things that can help change their minds. Because truly, in my view, when you begin to change your mind, you begin to change everything about how it is you exist in this world. Jason, do you have anything you want to add as we close the top of the second hour?
The thing to remember here is that when you're doing the kind of research that Crow and I do and a lot of you out there are interested in, it's very easy to become overwhelmed with it. It's you know, you start finding out more and more dark things about these people doing terrible things in the world. And why we did this was so that hopefully we can give you something to think about, to be able to step back, reflect on yourself, regather your strength, and then go back into the fray. So hopefully, you know, you at least look into some of what we went over today and get something good from it.
You know, the main point for me, well, let me back up a second. I get so many emails from people that say, you know, Crow, how can you take this? The more I find out, the lower I feel, the more hopeless I feel. And I tend to say the same thing to these people, hoping they will understand and read between the lines of what I am telling them. Nothing has changed from when you were just a little five-year-old kid. The only thing that has changed is what you know. In other words, how could you have been that five-year-old kid and been oblivious and perfectly happy to be where you were in this new enchanted place you found yourself? And now, because you know these things, you can't be happy anymore. Well, what is the difference? It's your mind. Your mind is the difference. If you learn to understand that these things are in fact probably going along all around you, and yeah, they could be depressing, if you get to a point where you just let go and let the riptide take you and become who you truly are, you will find that you can transcend the misery that you are projecting on yourself because of the dire straits of these systems others have put in place. That's my hope anyhow. Anyhow, that brings us to the top of the second hour. This has been Crow 777 Radio Episode 51 with Jason Lindgren, examining and contrasting the Eastern to Western mindsets. There it is, man. Cheers.